Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This week, we follow up on last week's discussion about the fight to keep gigantic fossil fuel projects from being built in the Northwest. Yesterday, we heard the amazing news that the Standing Rock Sioux water protectors have won their battle, at least for now, to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline from contaminating their water supply. This was much-needed good news after hearing last Tuesday that the Canadian federal government had approved Kinder Morgan's proposed expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline carrying tar sands oil across British Columbia. Today we're joined by Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute in Seattle, to talk about the connections between these two pipeline struggles and the forces we are trying to stave off that would turn the Pacific Northwest into a fossil fuel export hub. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Barbara. It's good to talk to you again.
And it's good to talk to you. Well, when we first were strategizing about this program a week ago, I think we were trying to figure out how to be less gloomy than everything felt. So we've had this gift of a reprieve. And so let's start with the good news, and then we can get back to the bad news after a while. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your take on this decision by the Army Corps of Engineers that was announced yesterday afternoon, basically to not give the easement to the pipeline company that would have been putting the Dakota Access Pipeline under the Missouri River. What is your sense about why this happened and what it means?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I was in shock when I heard the news yesterday afternoon. I did not expect it. I don't think many people saw this one coming. Usually when we get unexpected news, it's bad news. But this was, of course, very, very welcome. For those folks who aren't familiar with the project, it's a large pipeline that would move essentially shale oil, which is a lighter form of oil, out of the Dakota region, mostly the Bakken Formation, and pipe it down to Illinois for distribution to refineries and other oil centers. The decision yesterday was the Army Corps saying that they had not done sufficient consultation with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and that they were going to deny permits for the easement that the pipeline company wants across or underneath the Missouri River. What's interesting about that is the pipeline is basically done at this point. I mean, it's missing just this tiny little piece. It's like you have an entire jigsaw puzzle assembled, and all they've got to do is put in the last piece, and that's the piece that the tribe has been opposing and the water protectors have been opposing. So to issue this statement yesterday puts the company back on its heels in a major way. Vox is reporting that the company's already lost $100 million owing to delays. This is going to ratchet that loss up tremendously. There's a lot to say about it. I think it's unquestionably good news. Precisely what it means, I think, is a little more difficult to suss out, but might be fun to explore that for the next few minutes here.
Well, let's do that, because I sent out an announcement about, actually, I sent out an announcement about this show, but also I sent out an announcement for something else to my mailing list and got a prompt response from a friend who said that the Trump administration will, he said, his words was UFO anything that Obama does. So basically he saw this as like a hopeless fight. And I also read on Politico last night that there was expectations that the Trump administration would repeal this decision immediately. But I've read a lot of other things that make it seem like it's not quite so easy. It won't be quite so easy to undo this decision. And one of them has to do with the fact that they're opening up an environmental impact statement process rather than doing it as an executive order. Is this anything that you've kind of been looking at that you might want to talk about?
Sure, yeah. I mean, everything you just said is consistent with my understanding of how this works. Because they're going to begin this environmental review process and because they've issued a finding like this, the Trump administration is not able to simply step into office and by fiat approve the pipeline. They can do things to try to fast-track it. They can do things to try to monkey with the review process. But once that process is in place, anything they do to short-circuit it is then subject to judicial review. So that is to say, we can sue over it, and we would likely win in that case. And they would have to go through with conducting that review process, which is going to mean more delay and more expense for the company. It's also worth pointing out that this is a different kind of thing than an arm of the Obama executive branch, let's say the EPA or something, issuing a regulation, which is more likely for a new executive branch to step in and just walk it back. The Army Corps of Engineers, in decisions like this, is acting basically as the representative for the U.S. government in the enforcement of constitutionally protected by Article 2 of the Constitution treaty rights. And so when they issue a statement like this, it's not the sort of thing that you can just that you just sort of wave away. There's a whole big process and finding that has to go into doing something like that. So it really is. I wouldn't say it's bulletproof. It's not bulletproof, but it is certainly immune to a quick fix, or by the Trump administration.
Well, a lot of people are running their worst case scenario Trump nightmares. I shared one with you last week, which we won't repeat. But I guess I was talking to a programmer on my way into the station today, and it was concerned that that Trump would he would get the Congress to pass some kind of basically repeal whatever procedures there are that would for the environmental review. And I've heard of some other, I guess one thought is, what does Donald Trump care about protocol and laws? Because look what he did, talking to the president of Taiwan last week. So it does seem like there's a lot of uncertainty about the upcoming Trump administration, about their ability to follow laws and regulations. So does that raise any concern? Do you think there's any way that Trump could go rogue, so to speak, in a Sarah Palin kind of way, and do things that are totally beyond the scope of what our set of laws and regulations would allow?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I too have been spinning out my Trump post-apocalyptic end of democracy, sort of nightmare fantasies. But we don't know. I mean, I think at this point there's no telling what might happen. That's kind of in the range of maybe not quite law breaking, but disrespect for laws or disrespect for custom and convention. That's certainly all possible. I think the question that those scenarios raise is, well, how well established are other democratic institutions? For example, our courts and law enforcement. As I was saying earlier, anything the Trump administration would want to do to fast track this would either require an act of Congress, or would still be susceptible to judicial review. But anything they try to do by executive branch power could be taken to the courts. And so, then you're setting up a conflict between the executive branch and the judicial branch. How that sorts out in the end, I can't say. But I think it's right to think that we may be in a sort of brave new world where the traditional rules don't apply. That being said, I think this is still a victory. It's just not clear what the scale and scope of the victory is. And I do think there's maybe I'm just being optimistic here. I do think that there's a meaningful risk to the Trump administration of provoking too much public backlash. They may not be aware of that, but I think that the backlash is potentially huge and intransigent, and I think very favorable over the long term to those of us who want to stop fossil fuel infrastructure.
Well, I also was reading a very encouraging article the other day about the new attorney general for the state of California. And I can't remember the guy's name. He's a former congressman. And it sounds like he's going to be the Democratic progressive counterpart to that attorney general in Texas who was able to stop Obama's immigration executive order. So it seems like this is one of, I'm hoping, several forces that are in the wings waiting, with their lawsuits in hand, preempting any attempts that Trump might have to overturn things that we really care about. So that was one positive thing. The other thought that I've been having since yesterday, I was thinking about all the incredible spiritual power that was channeled and focused and concentrated at Standing Rock. And that was joined by over 3,000 vets who started showing up this past weekend. And it's such an amazing show of all kinds of force that it feels like it galvanizes something that we almost didn't remember we had. And I've seen a number of articles equating the scene on the bridge at Standing Rock a couple weeks ago with the police were using rubber bullets and concussion grenades, and this woman had her arm severely injured by it. That was very reminiscent of the Pettus Bridge massacre and the bloody Selma Sunday back in 1965. And these images, I think, are resonating across the country and across the world. And you sort of suggest that this is something that Trump might not be able to overcome.
Yeah, I think you just framed that up beautifully. I mean, I think it's hard to look at the images from Standing Rock and not invoke the civil rights era and not invoke the poor and the powerless standing up in numbers peacefully. Historically, we win with that kind of moral force, that kind of spiritual force, and frankly, those kind of images. I think it's real. I mean, it's been astonishing to me. I never would have predicted that Standing Rock, that the water protectors would have lasted this long in such incredibly harsh conditions. I mean, environmental conditions, and also incredibly ferocious tactics by law enforcement. And they haven't wavered. They've actually gotten stronger. I think the optics of the vets going there has been, I mean, it just chokes me up every time I think about it. A friend of mine is out there now too, missing his son's first birthday. And it's powerfully moving. I think it is to all Americans. My sense is that if the Trump administration fans the flames of that too much, I think we're going to see, you know, a tremendous backlash that's maybe comparable to what happened during the Civil Rights era. When I talk to people around my community or in my extended networks, I mean, there are so many people who are ready now to go and physically participate in demonstrations, in obstruction, and standing up to what they see as a grave injustice. And it's super powerful to me. But I mean, how that games out in the end, I think nobody really knows.
Actually, I was thinking of a couple conversations I've had. I was talking to an old friend on Saturday who was talking about, he was listening to something where there were a bunch of people at Standing Rock, and one of the women was asked, well, how long have you been an activist? And she said, I've been an activist for a week. I was a business major, and after the election, I changed my major to political science and sustainable studies. And here I am at Standing Rock. And I was telling him about a young friend I just made at Thanksgiving who was going to go down to his annual Christmas holiday road trip with his friends, and they were going to go down to Joshua Tree, change their minds, and they were going to go to Standing Rock. And I haven't talked to him yet to see if he's still planning on going out there. Because I guess that's another thing. Do you have any idea if it sounded to me yesterday that the encampment was going to break up? But what have you heard?
The same thing. I've heard that they're going to break it up and move on now that the process will take a different form, because at this point, they, as you said, they are conducting an environmental review, and they'll be looking at alternate routes. Really, given the physical limitations of winter setting in, it probably does make sense to break that camp up, provided that they actually do have the protections they think they do. I don't know anything definite other than what I've read in the media over the last, I guess, not that long, 12 hours or so.
Right. Well, one last thing before we move on to talking about the not-so-happy stories we need to talk about today. What is your sense about why the Army Corps at this 11th, I guess it was like the 11:55 hour, came in with this decision? I'm wondering how much you think it had to do with the forces that have been coalescing around the struggle in the last 6 months.
You know, I feel like all the questions you are asking this morning, my answers, I don't know. And I will say that I had a number of scenarios gamed out in my mind for the Dakota Access Pipeline, and an 11 hour 55 minutes decision by the Army Corps was not among those. So I'm frankly shocked. I will say it's consistent with one other big action that the Army Corps took recently, and for some listeners may know this already, but the Army Corps denied permits for a giant coal terminal on the Lummi Reservation in Northwest Washington, and that was a decision that was years in the making. It was a decisive victory for the Lummi Nation, and it was an example of the Army Corps, you know, using the power that's invested in it by the Constitution, essentially, to rule on behalf of tribal treaty rights claims. You can see, I think, in some ways, the decision at Standing Rock is perhaps an echo of the decision at Cherry Point. That's the Lummi project I'm referring to. And it's entirely possible to me, although I don't know this, but it's conceivable that, you know, if the Army Corps has begun to think about tribal treaty rights in the way that they seem to be now, that this could initiate a very large-scale problem for fossil fuel infrastructure projects in places where they're running afoul of treaty-protected lands.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace, who's a frequent guest here on Locus Focus. He's the policy director for Sightline Institute, and we've been talking about the decision at Standing Rock to basically uphold the tribe's treaty rights and to throw this project back to an environmental review, which hopefully will take years. And now we're going to move on and talk about kind of an equivalent project that's being foisted on the Pacific Northwest. Now, you talk about the strength of treaty rights. Let's talk about what the challenges are. Well, maybe we should back up a little bit, talk about what the Trans Mountain Pipeline is for people who haven't heard us talk about it on the show before, and what happened last week around that pipeline proposed, or the proposed expansion of that pipeline.
Sure. So the Trans Mountain Pipeline is the biggest and baddest fossil fuel project in the Northwest that Americans have never heard of. And what it is a giant oil pipeline in southern British Columbia that would move about 590,000 barrels of oil per day, which is roughly equivalent to it's roughly equivalent to everything that Washington can refine, and Washington refines fuel from most of the Northwest. Anyway, it's an enormous pipeline that would be constructed in southern British Columbia. It would move tar sands oil, some of the dirtiest and heaviest oil on the planet, to a port terminal near Vancouver, BC, for export. That has been fought for years by environmental advocates and by the tribes in British Columbia that are referred to as First Nations in Canada. And it's been fought alongside with some other oil projects having to do with the tar sands. And then last week, the Trudeau administration, which, as I assume most folks know, is a generally progressive administration, it's part of Canada's Liberal Party. They took a number of actions. They actually took five important actions for Canadian energy policy, some of which were good. But among those decisions was the decision to approve the Trans Mountain Pipeline. And so what that does is tee up an enormous showdown, basically, between the pipeline builders, a company called Kinder Morgan, and the Canadian federal government, who's on their side, a showdown between them and essentially the province of British Columbia, some of the localities like Vancouver and Burnaby, and then environmentalists, First Nations, and then anybody else who's not wild about having that much oil piped directly to the shores of the Salish Sea.
Well, it's interesting. On the one hand, Justin Trudeau has come down very hard on the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which was seen as a worse affront. I guess the only thing that I can think about that was worse than the Trans Mountain Pipeline was it isn't built yet. So it was not, it was going to just take virgin territory and just decimate it. And it was being proposed to wind up at Kitimat on the coast of British Columbia, way far north of the northern tip of Vancouver Island. So Justin Trudeau killed that in effect by banning all supertanker traffic north of Vancouver Island. And now it seems ironic. So it's okay to increase tanker traffic south of or around Vancouver Island and south of it, because the tankers from the Burnaby terminal would be going out to sea around going through the Salish Sea and going out to the Pacific Ocean around the bottom of Vancouver Island and through the San Juans and, I mean, really sensitive areas. So why is he allowing? I'm wondering what kind of logic is there that you understand the danger of having any tanker traffic in the incredibly fjord, island-laden sea coastline north of Vancouver, and allowing it to really expand south of Vancouver Island, where in fact it's a similar kind of very complex coastline.
Right. I mean, the question you posed is what kind of logic is at work, and I think logic does not apply in this scenario. I mean, it's completely inconsistent. As you said, so there were originally, as you indicated, there were two pipelines that were planned to move Alberta tar sands oil to the coast. The Northern Gateway, which Trudeau formally rejected now. He also made permanent a moratorium that had been in place around oil tankers on the north coast of British Columbia. And then at the same time that he did that, he approved the Trans Mountain, the southern pipeline, and puts that into a much busier vessel traffic area. So with the completion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, it would add 348 loaded oil tankers per year, all moving very close to the San Juan Islands and then out the Strait of Juan de Fuca, past the Olympic National Wildlife Refuge on the coast and all that. Very sensitive, very important area. The principal difference in my view, there is, I think, good evidence to support this, is that, quite frankly, then the Canadians get to rely on American Coast Guard and spill response to protect those waterways. It is fairly clear at this point that the Canadians do not have an adequate spill response program for coastal areas, nor do they have a Coast Guard that functions anything like ours. Ours is a military branch. Theirs is not. So there is a real sense in which the Trudeau administration is essentially offloading the responsibility for this stuff, as well as the direct threat, onto American waters. I don't want to get into some sort of like chest bumping exercise about sort of sovereignty issues and foreign relations, but I think there is a very viable interpretation of these events as saying, well, we're not going to build it up in the sensitive areas that we can't protect of our own country. We're going to put it down right on your border, knowing that the Americans will step in with infrastructure and resources to try to protect it. As it turns out, though, there are lots and lots of places where an oil spill would be catastrophic, even with the better infrastructure that the American Coast Guard and spill response programs have to bring to bear on these on these routes.
What would also be catastrophic up in Canada? I was rereading your facts about Kinder Morgan this morning and reminding me of that incredible gusher of oil in Burnaby in 2007, I believe. And I mean, that did, it affected 50 homes or something, but it was pretty awful. And it was a relatively small accident compared to what can happen. But there's lots of room. There was an oil spill in the Burrard Inlet, I guess, last year, and another couple in the Georgia Strait. I mean, these happen already. So there's a lot of places for there to be damage in Canadian territorial waters before they cross the 49th parallel.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. So I mean, there are definitely risks to the Canadian waters as well, no question about it. But of course, you know, all those waterways are they're territorially shared in many senses. So you go through what's called the Haro Strait or the Strait of Juan de Fuca. You know, depending on what the tides and currents and winds are doing, that oil could wash into Canadian onto Canadian shores or into American. And so there's sort of no. It's very difficult to, in principle, divide like kind of who gets the oil if you know, when it's spilled there. The other thing that I think is really interesting is in October there was a tug that spilled, the Nathan Stewart, on the north coast of BC. It was small enough to be able to operate there despite the tanker moratorium that was in place at the time. And you know, the spill response to that by the Canadians was abysmal. And you know, Sightline has we actually did a sort of a point by point write up on exactly what happened chronologically with that spill. But you know, the upshot is that it was an absolute failure to contain a rather modest oil spill. And who gets the brunt of it? It's of course the First Nations and their natural resources that they depend on. And so, you know, even Premier Christy Clark, that's the Premier of British Columbia, said, you know, this is completely inadequate. And yet now the Canadian federal government seems to be okay with approving a big new pipeline. When there's no demonstrated evidence that anybody has the ability to deal with this stuff.
Well, I found interesting, too, and I was doing some work on this a couple of years ago, that the Tualatin First Nation, who live on the Burrard Inlet, right across the inlet from the Kinder Morgan Terminal, they were saying that they're the ones who are going to be responsible for cleaning up spills. And they are the first responders. And it's not like they feel like they have any special expertise, but that's kind of the way it's set up. I'm wondering if that's something that you have talked to people about and what that would mean.
Yes, I mean, this is what happened with the Nathan Stewart tug sinking that I was just talking about a moment ago. The first responders were actually the First Nations. They arrived, did their best they could to contain it, but they're given very inadequate resources to try and do that kind of thing. And it ends up being 18 hours or 2 or 3 days before the right kind of infrastructure and booming equipment gets in place to contain it. At that point, you know, 90% of the oil is lost. And by lost, I don't mean it's vanished from the earth. I mean it's onshore, it's sunk onto the seafloor, done other things that we don't want it to do.
And this is tar sands oil, which sinks.
Yeah, the Nathan Stewart was a similar kind of oil. It was actually a little different. But the stuff that we would have coming out of the Kinder Morgan pipeline is tar sands oil. And number one, it's very, very toxic. It's not the sort of thing, like if you had a glass of it on your desk, you would want to get away from it. It's not safe to be around. It is a combination of this heavy sludge-like oil that is mined in Alberta. It's sort of dug out. It comes out like almost like sandy peanut butter. And then it is mixed with what's called condensate, which is a lighter volatile petroleum product. And they blend those together in order to make it flow through a pipeline, and that's the result is called diluted bitumen or dilbit. And both of those components of it, the condensate and the bitumen itself, have toxic properties. And so it's, you know, you don't just like put on a pair of gloves and go wade out and clean this stuff up. It's not safe. And then on top of that, the bitumen portion of it is quite heavy. It's heavier than water, and so it tends to sink. And so what we, in the event of a spill, this stuff might get washed onto shore, where it would, you know, create basically a sludge-like coating on the beach, or it would sink onto the seafloor and couldn't be cleaned up. We've seen that happen. There's a, you know, there's a famous Dilbit spill on the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. And, you know, Sightline has also done a detailed write-up of what happened in that spill. But the upshot is that almost all the oil goes unrecovered. It has been a long-lasting, ongoing environmental pollution problem that's severely damaged that river and may at some point end up damaging the Great Lakes.
Now, that was Enbridge, that pipeline, correct?
That was Enbridge,
and
yes.
And Enbridge was going to be the pipeline company for the Northern Gateway. So that's just like a small sampling of some of the, I guess you could call them crimes against nature that Enbridge has committed. But let's move on to Kinder Morgan's track record and what one would expect from this company that's owned this pipeline in across British Columbia since 2005. But it also, they have facilities here in Portland for storing fossil fuels. I saw a Kinder Morgan representative at the hearing at City Council a couple weeks ago, and the City Council was putting into place, going through the final stages of putting into place, a total ban on any future fossil fuel storage facilities in Portland. And actually, I was kind of impressed by the Kinder Morgan person. He said that he felt like he'd come to a barbecue and he was the meat. And he was explaining why the 10% increase in storage facility that would be allowed if the companies did seismic upgrades was not enough, and they really needed 20 to 30 or 40% in order for it to pencil out. In which case, and after hearing that, the city council went, I guess we'll go down to zero like everybody wants us to do. So anyway, so that's Kinder Morgan. But why don't we talk a bit more about their safety or lack of safety record and what that would bode for the expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline?
Yeah, so a great question. So Kinder Morgan is a company that I became super interested in a few years back when they were proposing a large coal terminal on the Lower Columbia River down near Klatskanai. And at the time, they had been making some claims about their safety record with handling coal specifically, and so I started taking a look at their track record everywhere. And as it turns out, they have an absolutely abysmal track record. A couple of the more notable things from the Pacific Northwest. You mentioned an oil spill in Canada that was in Burnaby, and that was actually on Kinder Morgan's existing Trans Mountain pipeline. So they own an existing pipeline there, and they're going to build it. They're planning to build a second one that's about twice as big alongside of it, which is what we've been talking about. That rupture in Burnaby, I mean, there's video of it. You can go to YouTube and find it, and it's like literally just gushing this gunk straight out into a suburban neighborhood, basically. But their record with pipelines has been lousy all over the place. So they've been criticized even by the financial community for failing to invest in pipeline safety and maintenance to the extent that other pipeline companies do. But they sort of go beyond just sort of failing to operate their infrastructure correctly. They have been prosecuted and convicted by the federal government of stealing coal from their own customers and then reselling it to other customers. They have been convicted in one famous case from Portland. They were in possession of some contaminated fertilizer on their property, and so they loaded up, I think it was 150 tons of it, onto a ship, bribed the ship captain. He went out to the Pacific Ocean, dumped it, and then came right back in, which is, of course, a violation of federal marine law. And they were eventually found out based on a worker who was a whistleblower. But, you know, just this just grotesque corporate track record, not only of failing to operate their infrastructure, but of outright lies, deception, law-breaking. I mean, the bribery case is just staggering to me.
Well, actually, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Eric DePlace, who is the policy director for Sightline Institute in Seattle. We've been talking about, this is sort of the tale of two pipelines this morning, and we've talked in the beginning about the success of stopping the Dakota Access Pipeline from going under the Missouri River, at least for now, and a stunning victory for the tribes who have been fighting that pipeline for a very long time. And now we're talking about the proposed expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline that would cross British Columbia, which already does cross British Columbia, but would be greatly expanded. And it would carry tar sands oil from the tar sands in Alberta to Burnaby, right next door to Vancouver, where it would be put on barges and shipped down to Anacortes, where it would be made into gasoline that goes into our cars. One of the things that I, when I was first learning about this pipeline a few years ago, that kind of struck me was how hard it is once you have infrastructure in place to keep it from getting bigger. And that one of the reasons why, as we mentioned earlier, the Northern Gateway Pipeline was resisted by a much wider spectrum of political leaders than the Trans Mountain Pipeline was, it wasn't there yet. But I talked to people a couple of years ago in Calgary who were saying, well, the Trans Mountain Pipeline was built in, I guess it was built in the 50s, and nobody objected to it going through some rather major natural areas in British Columbia. And, you know, why, and it's been operating safely, so why not expand it? So what do you see as a problem with the fact that that pipeline actually already exists? And let's talk a little about the route that it takes, because it does go, I was amazed to learn where it went.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, first of all, it hasn't been operating safely. I mean, it did rupture in Burnaby. It's had other small ruptures all along the route. But it's true that in the 1950s, in Canada and in the United States, we used to approve oil pipelines and other infrastructure through very sensitive places without proper review. I think we've been reaping the seeds, or reaping that harvest for a while now. You know, I think that the underlying principle here is one that's really worth keeping in mind, is that, you know, when we build up hard infrastructure to deliver fossil fuels, it is with us for a long, long time. Even if it is originally sold as a 20 or 30 year project, which is usually referring to kind of the point at which they've paid back their investors, their initial investors, there is all kinds of pressure then to rebuild, expand, elaborate that infrastructure and continue to use it. So when we think about trying to transition away from oil for, let's say, climate reasons, you can't credibly, as Justin Trudeau tried to argue, you cannot sort of say, well, we're going to build this out, and we'll just run it for a while, just for a couple of decades, and then we'll stop using oil. All of history suggests that the opposite happens, that once it's there, then there's all kinds of pressure to continue to expand it and operate it. So it poses, I think, a really serious long-term threat from that perspective. You know, but then also, you know, there is a question, too, about whether we will continue to be able to maintain these things and then someday safely decommission them once they do eventually go out of service, because eventually they'll have to. And that's just not something that anybody has a lot of experience with. I think decommissioning something like the Trans Mountain Pipeline, particularly its new expanded form, you know, if that happens someday, would be extremely challenging.
Well, let's talk about the opposition. The tribes, the First Nations in Canada, have declared frequently, starting with the Northern Gateway, but I understand now with the Trans Mountain Pipeline as well, that they would be a wall of resistance, an unbroken wall of resistance. What does that mean, and what kind of legal teeth does that have?
Yeah, and I think we have to right now look no further really than the Standing Rock Sioux. I mean, I think that they will be taking their cues to an extent from what's happened at Standing Rock. The Silvertooth and many of the First Nations there have said right that they will oppose it any way that they can, and also the U.S. tribes have said that they'll do the same thing. So there are actually four of the North Puget Sound tribes who have formally intervened or tried to intervene in the Canadian regulatory proceedings, saying that this affects their tribal treaty rights, which then invokes a sort of government-to-government relationships, not only between the tribes and the U.S. government, but between the U.S. government and Canada. They are willing to do exactly what happened at Standing Rock, and that is physically obstruct the construction of that pipeline. And so I think we are right on the cusp of a level of sort of civil disobedience and public protest that we haven't. I mean, I think it could well exceed what we saw at Standing Rock. Standing Rock is far from urban centers. It's you know, it's hostile terrain politically. The climate is challenging there as well. Trying to construct a pipeline basically through the heart of protest country. I mean, through Vancouver, you know, where you can, it's a quick bus ride from Seattle or Portland. I think that they are. I think that there's no telling how many people could show up to physically obstruct that thing, and it could be tens of thousands of people who stand in the way of it. My suspicion is that the Trudeau administration, that nobody really is adequately prepared for the ferocity of that kind of pushback. But I think it's real, and I think it's coming.
Well, actually, I was wondering about physically protesting the pipeline construction all the way across British Columbia. It goes through some places that are even more remote than Standing Rock. Going through the mountains, it's going to go through quite a bit of Alberta, too, before it gets to the mountains. But going through all those rugged mountains in eastern BC is, I would imagine, a challenge both for the pipeline company, but also for protesters to be able to do encampments and to try to stop it there.
Yeah, I would think that would be very challenging. And I don't know enough about the physical geography of the entire route. My suspicion is that the concentration of protests will really be on or near the coast. It's the coastal tribes who have been the most adamantly opposed to the project. And it's also, of course, nearest the urban centers and home to most of the people who would oppose it. And one example, actually, Mayor Robertson from Vancouver has not been mincing words about his opposition to it. The mayor of Burnaby has said that he will prevent construction workers from entering his municipality to work on the project. It's not clear to me that he has the authority to do that, but it's pretty clear that the municipal governments, as you get down toward the saltwater, are very, very unhappy about this, and that could pose a whole range of issues. I mean, if they are condoning or helping support a protest movement, you'd almost have the opposite of Standing Rock, where local law enforcement might be on their side.
Also, I was under the impression, I know that a couple of years ago, Christy Clark, the premier of British Columbia, was a supporter of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. But from what I was reading after the federal decision, it sounds like she's maybe not so crazy about it anymore.
Yeah, there are lots of different reads of what she's doing right now. I'm skeptical myself, but she is savvy enough as a politician to realize that there's a tremendous risk to being seen as supporting the pipeline. There are huge constituencies, obviously, within British Columbia that are bitterly opposed to the pipeline. As well, there is a very demonstrated real risk of oil spills, especially with the grounding of the Nathan Stewart tug, which sort of proved the point. And so she has been sort of modulating her tone about this. She seems to be trying to project the image of opposed to it, but it's not sort of a full-throated opposition.
Not like the mayor of Burnaby.
Yeah, right, exactly. And there are those who say, well, once she wins re-election, then she'll come out and support the pipeline. Who knows? I don't think that's probably right either. But in a way, I think Christy Clark is maybe a good example of the ways in which we often expect our political leaders to lead ahead of their constituencies, instead of building up a movement and a moral call and demonstrating that we have the ability to make these things serious political issues. A politician like Christy Clark, she's to an extent a weather vane. If we can demonstrate the resistance and the breadth of the resistance, she'll probably go along with that, and that's probably good enough.
So, in the next few weeks and months, what should people be looking for, and how can they get involved?
Well, I think pay close attention to what's happening with the Trans Mountain Pipeline. We won't know for sure exactly how that's going to play out, but my guess is that by summer or fall, we'll be starting to see coordinated opposition movements up in British Columbia. I would also say that there are other important projects in the Pacific Northwest, and I do want to—I know we're almost out of time—but I wanted to, tell folks to pay attention to the big oil train project at Vancouver, the Vancouver Energy Project, biggest oil by rail unloading facility anywhere in North America. We've got a big coal terminal, biggest coal terminal in North America, scheduled for Longview. We'll have a decision about that probably in 2017, and then a couple of these ridiculous methanol refinery projects on the Columbia River. So lots of stuff in kind of the South Washington, North Oregon, kind of Portland general area for people to pay attention to and to get involved with down there.
So in this coming Trump reality that we are going to be entering, might be more like reality television than actual reality. How do you see that we should be focusing? I'm actually thinking about a line that John Oliver said on his last show for the season right after the elections. He said, "Write on your refrigerator, this is not normal."
That's probably great advice. I think the attention now turns to states and localities. We have pretty good state leadership in both Oregon and Washington. That's certainly positive. And I think what's happening in Portland is a great case study for what could happen in lots of other places. Portland is essentially banning new fossil fuel infrastructure within city limits, and they're doing it in a way that's remarkably comprehensive and I think thoughtful. And my sense is that what Portland is doing could be replicated in many, many other places, where you're basically using the enforcement power of local land use law to build the bricks in the wall for what I call the thin green line. And that's the way that we can oppose the fossil fuel industry, we can stop them from building their projects, and we can do it with local authority, where we win all the time against the coal and oil companies.
And I want to let people know that this Thursday at 2:00, the City Council will be voting on that ordinance, and you can go down and support them. It starts at 2:00, and something that I think we can all be very proud of as Portlanders. Well, Eric, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's always good to talk to you. We'll check in again probably pretty soon and do an update on all these things that we talked about today.
Great. Thank you so much, Barbara.
Sure. Thank you. We've been talking with Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Michael Wetter and Philip Liu about the Intertwine Alliance and why it's so important to protect networks of nature within urban areas. My engineer is Jenka Sodenberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go with some music by Robbie Robertson. Thanks for listening.